in our school system. So I think that this bill is fair to teachers and protects the best interests of the students. And I ask you to support this bill and move it out of committee.
Thank you. Questions?
Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Gene. How are you?
Good.
Marilyn, he's on his best behavior today, so you can tell everybody back in Valdez. Next, we'll hear from Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Chairman Codd. My name is Willie Anderson. I work for NEA Alaska. I could comment on all three items in this bill, but I would like to focus on the de novo trial judicial review, as it's titled. I would like to take the opportunity just to walk through what happens when you terminate a teacher employment. First, the principal makes the recommendation to the superintendent. The superintendent concurs with that recommendation. Then the superintendent makes a recommendation to the board. The board concurs with that recommendation. After the board concurs, the superintendent is directed to send a letter of non-retention or dismissal to a teacher. I would like to repeat that part of it. After the board concurs with that recommendation, the superintendent is directed to send a letter of non-retention or dismissal with the teacher. So the board is in part of the decision to non-retain the teacher. Then the teacher has 15 days to request a hearing before that board. Now, we're going to get a fair hearing out of this board. And so we request a hearing before the board, and the board reviews the information again. And I've handled a number of these cases, and in every case, the board retains its earlier decision. What we're seeking is a fair hearing. I would like for you to contemplate, how do you get a fair hearing when the board that makes the final decision about your retention has already made a decision about your non-retention? The process is convoluted, and you cannot get a fair hearing from a board that's already made a decision. For the board to make a fair hearing, they would have to reverse their earlier decision. There's no other employee, state employee, public employee, or even private employer that have that type of situation set up for them. Under the provision of this bill, that's what will happen. Currently, there's a negotiated agreement in many of the school districts around the state. We can negotiate and arbitrate a 10-day suspension without pay. An independent arbitrator comes in and renders a decision on that cause, and he or she can reinstate the 10-day suspension. We can arbitrate a transfer denial. An independent arbitrator comes in and makes a decision about that decision. But we are denying an independent hearing officer to make a decision about the retention of a person's career. That's the problem with this bill as it's currently structured. I tend to believe that people have this belief that we are going to get an independent hearing from a school board. Mr. Josephson stated earlier that the courts in Matsu have stated, one, that the board have no independent judicial review training. Administrative procedures as is currently constituted in the state law is different than what is constituted here. What we're asking for of you at this time is a fair hearing, be it a de novo trial that's currently in law, or be it a binding arbitration decision. That's our request of you. We want one shot at the apple for a fair hearing. People have characterized it, you get two shots at the apple. You get a board hearing, and you get a de novo trial. Well, get rid of the board hearing, because we know the outcome of the board hearing. They've already made their decision earlier, when they concurred with the superintendent's recommendation. That's the point where we have serious concerns about fairness and equity for teachers in this bill. We will simply request of you one fair hearing. That's our request of you at this point. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Willie, Representative Cavini.
Mr. Chairman, he brings up a very good point, and go ahead.
Wait.
I guess I'm speaking to you more than I am him. I'm sorry. He brings up a very good point, and it's one where I have witnessed. We've only had twice. We only had two grievances in 17 years that I've been involved in Valdez, and I served as the president of the union for many years. A very good point. A superintendent goes to a school board, and they talk about it. That board not backing up that superintendent, and I wish we still had one here, is almost like a vote of no confidence. If that board virtually in 99% of the time will go along with what the superintendent has done, especially if it's public knowledge, or else it's like giving that superintendent a vote of no confidence, and almost, I'm serious, it goes this far, because he would be, or she would be, almost humiliated or contradicted to all of their employees. And so they never, even though if they know that person is wrong, they would, you know how far they would go? They would go to rule against you and wait a year and get rid of the superintendent knowing he's wrong at them, but they would not, I've never seen it, reverse him in front of everybody. It's like a slap in the face to him. It's a vote of no confidence. It's a very good point, and I think Willie explained the procedure very well.
Representative Elton.
This is not a question either, but I mean, this has been one of the clearest presentations we've had before the committee so far on the hearing process, and it's similar to situations that I've been involved in the past, and in my service on the local assembly, the assembly would make a determination on issuing a major mine permit to an operator that wanted to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in this community. That permit decision made by the assembly can be appealed, and it's heard by the assembly, again sitting as a quasi-judicial body. I can tell you that when we heard the appeal for the second time, it was compelling to know that our decision sitting as a quasi-judicial body was appealable to the Superior Court. Because without that appeal, I mean, I can tell you having sat through some of these, without that appeal, you're more apt to make a political decision than not. And I think that's maybe the case here, too, that if a school board knows that their second hearing process can be reviewed and can be second-guessed, I think you induce a much better second hearing on the part of the school board.
Representative Porter.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know how many more people you have to testify, but perhaps since I understand you're going to be adjourning close to 5 and then trying to return, that if we have people that want to testify, we'd be best served by getting them in rather than debating the bill at this time.
That is my intent. We have two more. This particular point, since the issue was clearly articulated, I think there is a little bit of a problem in the way this is set up. I would agree that the school board would just reaffirm their earlier decision. Representative Roper.
Mr. Anderson, in the Anchorage School District, don't they use hearing officers, or how prevalent are hearing officers used in the state?
In the Anchorage School District, they do use hearing officers, and generally the school board concurs with the hearing officer's decision. I have not seen a case in Anchorage, and I've worked at Anchorage as a staffer for NEA Alaska. I have not seen a case in Anchorage where they haven't concurred with the hearing officer's decision.
And Mr. Chairman, and at those hearings, the person who requests the hearing, do they normally have counsel, or is counsel represented on both sides, or how does that work?
It's a mixed bag, representative, through the chair, Representative Roberg. Generally for a tenured teacher, there's counsel representing both sides. For a non-tenured teacher, there's generally counsel representing the school board, and a person who doesn't have legal training like myself representing the teacher.
And one more question, sir, on that point. where are the hearing officers drawn? Who are these people?
There's a panel of hearing officers that the Anchor School District has in panel to hear these matters.
Mr. Anderson, how many of these cases have you observed?
I've participated personally in 12 of the cases in Alaska in the last 8 years.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Marshall.
For the record, my name is Vernon Marshall. I'm Executive Director of NEA Alaska, and I want to offer some comments relative to the basic features of the bill, dealing with probation, layoff, and a brief comment on de novo. And I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee. I think that, Mr. Gleason made a great point, and that is the time that it takes to evaluate staff. And maybe we should be saying that time should be prioritized, because I think the development of any staff is critical to management of any system, whether it's a school district, a newspaper, or a police force. But if you assume that you have 50 teachers or 50 staff, 35 teachers and 15 support, we're looking at 50 people. If we spent 3 hours on those three people on the average, that's 150 hours a year. If we really, did well and got 300 hours a year, we're only looking at maybe 4% of this individual's time if they put in 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, for 180 days of instruction, or 7,200 hours. The critical issue here is still time. If we don't make those valuable, and I'm going to speak in terms of a beginning teacher. I think a beginning teacher does need help. They need assistance. They need more than a set of keys and a box of chalk to go out and do their jobs. They need the mentoring and the assistance that valuable administrators can provide them. I think if we set up a system that delays that process 2 more years, we are doing not only a disservice to children, but we're doing a disservice to that teacher. Nothing in this bill now prescribes any kind of mentoring, any kind of in-service, any kind of accelerated certification, any kind of classroom management training. We're not even talking about 5-year programs at the college level to prepare teachers for the classroom. We're not talking about site-based decision making. But yet, for some reason, it's in the wisdom of someone to indicate that we need to move from 2 to 4 years of probation. And we have asked, why? And all we hear is time, but if we don't carve out additional time for that administrator to be successful, that time will be eaten up relative to community school relations, relative to violence, and all the other issues that a principal has to deal with. The other point on the layoff, we are concerned about that section. Over on page 3 of the bill, when you look at line 7, it does provide for a layoff of teachers because of decreased school attendance, but it also goes on and indicates that if the basic need of the school district determined under the law and adjusted under the law decreases by 3% or more from the previous year. Quite frankly, we see this as a tremendous safety valve. In other words, right now we've got bills before the legislature that will fund schools next year at about $59,000. We feel if the basic need in a school district is $61,000, if you reduce that basic need by 3% or $1,830, you've got a value of $59,170. The disincentive here is not to fund the unit. And we feel that there is a burden and there is a responsibility on government to ensure that schools are adequately funded and that they are provided the necessary resources to be innovative, to be different, to meet the challenges of the new decade, as the PTA people pointed earlier. I think it's unfair to expect both administrators, school boards, systems, teachers to do more with less. And every year, they have to deal with the fact that they are not getting any kind of adjustment for inflation. but yet they're expected to, in a sense, absorb those costs into the system. But now we come forward with a provision in the law that simply allows and mandates that the state will allow a school district to, in effect, balance budgets on the backs of children and tenured teachers in this case. On line 8, that section only applies to tenured teachers. So, in effect, we could apply this section. If this adjustment takes place, we get rid of tenured teachers. There's no responsibility to get rid or no requirement to get rid of non-tenured teachers. So, for the most part, the seniority system is not effective or operative at all if this provision is triggered. At the same time, what will happen? Class sizes will likely increase. As you go down to line 17 of the bill, the layoff provision, that's all permissive. It's indicating a school district may do that. There's nothing in there that requires a school district to provide for provisions that deal with layoff or retention. The same is carried through on line 24, where the section may not be inconsistent with provisions of this section. Line 21 through 25, we do feel we've got many collective bargaining agreements in school districts throughout the state. These have been decided locally. They deal with this issue, but yet this particular provision will circumvent what has been decided over time on the local level, and we need to be aware of that. We're concerned about line 31. And someone mentioned earlier that if someone, I think it was the superintendent of schools, if a person is laid off in September, October, November, or December, they may look very carefully at line 31. They have no job. They will probably be drawing unemployment, and they probably will look for extra funds, so they will go and be treated as a terminated employee for purposes of pulling out money from their teacher retirement account. Now, again, they may go through life, and they may have a temporary problem finding a job, but if they ever enter the system again, and they're looking at, say, working in that system 5 years after layoff or 2 years after layoff, and they've spent that retirement, it's really difficult. And I guess I'm not trying to say the teacher is irresponsible, but it's very difficult to come up with 10 years of service plus the interest and, you know, pay that back in if they put another 10 years in and they wanted to achieve, say, 20 years of service. The final point on the judicial review. I kind of relate this. What we are most concerned with relative to the judicial review based on the record and what the judge will do. It's our understanding that the judge will apply what's called a substantial basis test. And basically, that test will be, is there any rationale or evidence in the record to support the decision? In other words, a decision was made to non-renew a teacher. Is there any rational evidence? Or is there any rationale period that supports the decision? That's the test. The judge, based on what we have been told by our lawyer, is not going to have the ability to go back and say, well, I believe this record is wrong. I believe the school board was wrong. And based on what I believe, and the judge using his or her mind, they cannot overturn that particular decision. That causes us a great deal of anxiety because that test then becomes extremely low when you apply it to a teacher in a school district. The other is the burden of proof. We are concerned. Does the burden shift when you, in a sense, send the record to the judge? Now is the burden of proving that the school district was wrong shifted to the teacher, or does the school district still have the burden of proving its case against the tenured teacher? Keeping in mind, many times this person could lose their license because there's another step in this process that wasn't explained by the folks here, and that's called a PTPC. They can very well take up the case after the dismissal if it's an incompetence immorality charge, and they can lose their license to practice in the state of Alaska. The other is just in terms of probation. As I understand it, in terms of our state law, as it applies to state employees, and earlier on in earlier committees before Hess, it was argued that Basically, what we want to do is set up a system that somewhat equates to what applies to state employees. Right now, as we understand it, if you range 13 and below, you have a six-month probationary period. After the six-month probationary period, you have a just cause standard to dismiss that individual. If you are a range 14 and above, you have a one-year probationary period, and just cause becomes the standard for dismissal of that particular employee. In this particular case, we're saying you are an at-will employee. You can be dismissed for no reason, any reason, just because for 4 years of employment within a district, you're gone. There is no reason. And earlier, the business about denial of tenure. If tenure is denied to me in a school district, I have no recourse to the courts. I just simply take the denial, pack my bag, and try to find another job. And there is no portability. I can't take 3 years in Anchorage, come down to Juneau and say, well, I made it for three, I lost one, I'd like to apply the three and hopefully get four more so I can be a tenured teacher in Juneau, Alaska. There's no portability. You've got 4 years, 4 years is it. There is, you are totally at will. And again, we feel that when you compare that to other public employees, it is not fair. And we are, as President Douglas pointed out, we're willing to look at ways to improve evaluation. We'd like to see. I hope evaluation is a tool that's used to help people improve and not to prove. But it seems like we're talking about a lot of proof here. But if we could, you know, use evaluation in year one, help that beginning teacher, year two, help that beginning teacher. If that person is making progress, give a third year. Or if you want to do 2 years, at least give them a cause standard like we do other state employees. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Vern. Questions? Seeing none.
Well done.
Representative Covina, did you have a comment, question?
No, sir.
Now we have a Mr. Bob Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bob Dietrich. I'm president-elect of the Juneau Education Association. I'm beginning my third term with this association. And during my tenure as an association representative as well as a teacher in our school district, I've had the opportunity to observe, witness, and participate in many of the issues that you're addressing in this bill. The first one that I'd like to address is acquisition of tenure. I have testified before the Alaska 2000 Committee that we do need to take a look at how tenure is granted in this state. I do not believe that somebody who teaches 2 years should automatically be granted tenure. I do believe that somebody who has taught 2 years should have an opportunity to apply for tenure, that there should be a built-in provision and funding provided for for local school districts, provide a peer review committee, provide master teachers, to provide mentoring process, so that when we know we're granting tenure to somebody in our school district, that we as a school district believe this is an individual that we want to keep in our community to work with our children. I have not changed my position on that. I think that 4 years is a lengthy time period. If we have an inadequate teacher, I don't think we ought to be dumping money into their pockets for 4 years. I think if a person after 2 years applies is not granted tenure, that they have 1 year to get their act together, working with the mentor teacher, working with master teachers, peer review committees, or possibly even the university system to try to get this teacher up to snuff so that they are somebody we want to keep in our system. The area of layoffs, what I would like to address is that we have a layoff provision in our negotiated agreement. I think our negotiated agreement speaks well to the process for layoffs of non-tenured teachers and can, in fact, go into a tenured teacher layoff under certain conditions. The 3% figure that we see in this bill causes me great concern. If the 3% figure is a result of a drop in enrollment, then how are we going to define what a substantial drop in enrollment is in order to attack the tenured teaching force? If you have any bills that go through that lower the value of the instructional unit, that is going to be a major impact on our professional, experienced staff that we have in our communities. When you start talking a 3% figure, and I heard Mr. Rose testify last night that You know, a school board wouldn't lay off teachers with a minimal amount of money in consideration. In our school district, last year, we had about 50 teachers laid off, nearly half of them rehired so they didn't have a break in service. During this school year, during this time when we have over 20 teachers sitting out there on a recall list, our school board, in its wisdom, hired additional administration. They increased the number of administrators in the bargaining unit. They have also increased the school board budget so that they can pay their Alaska Association of School Board dues while we have teachers sitting out there waiting for jobs. I don't think that this 3% figure is going to allow equal treatment in our system. I think that the administrative direction that we've been observing in our community is a concern. In 1987, we had a number of teachers on layoff. We had a unilaterally imposed salary cut in our bargaining unit, and at the same time, we saw school administrators get a salary increase. So if you're looking at a 3% figure, who's going to monitor how school districts are laying off and spending their money? In the area of hiring preference, you know, a number of negotiated agreements speak to hiring preference. At the same time, we've seen a number of grievances occur in what defines preference. You have no definition of preference in this bill. Who's going to define preference in a hiring or rehiring process, as well as qualifications? We attempted to negotiate language which provides definition for qualifications, and when we find that we try to deal with qualifications and working with the school board or administration, there's always an attack on what is the definition of qualifications. Is it based on being endorsed in a certain area, or is it having a Type A certificate? And what qualifies me to work at elementary level? What allows me to work at a secondary level? And in the area of qualifications, we've seen wonderful people who've had to leave a secondary position because of rollbacks in the secondary level go into an elementary classroom and do a wonderful job. And in our district, we've seen elementary people go into the high school and do a wonderful job. We are trained to be educators. We are trained to be professionals. And I think that we also need to be careful with messing with local control. I think local control is a key point that we need to consider when we're going to make legislation that's going to affect negotiated agreements. We sit down with our school boards and we negotiate a contract that we believe we can all live with. If we truly believe that the bargaining process is a valid process in this state, let's not mess with local control. And you know, the TRS refund, if you're non-retained and you go broke, you know, what I've seen over the years is people coming back to school to work and wish they had not taken that money out of the state. They wish they still kept that amount that they had for their previous years of experience in the state in the TRS. It impacts them the rest of their life as they grow older in the state, and who knows when they'll retire. In terms of budget considerations for layoff, I think that we need to encourage an early retirement bill. I think we need to encourage local retirement incentives. Last year, our school district in the association, the school board, negotiated an early retirement incentive plan where teachers got $10,000 if they resigned or retired. They had to be at certain conditions on the salary schedule to save money for the district. Our district saved nearly $1 million, and that's what allowed the rehire of about half of those that were laid off the previous spring. In terms of the trial de novo, I think Mr. Anderson spoke to it very well. I think that you need to be aware of what goes in the evaluations. What goes in an evaluation, we cannot remove from an evaluation. I've worked with building principals, I've worked with personnel directors on the kinds of things that are going into evaluations, and I question the types of comments that are going into evaluations, whether they're valid, whether they're observable. Try to get them removed just like pulling teeth. We cannot go in and just say this is an unfair statement, this is an inadequate statement, remove it from the evaluation. All we can do is attach a rebuttal. And if evaluations are going to be used for a board hearing improving a teacher's incompetence, then we need to have some way of having a counter position and some way of having an impartial hearing in order to present our case. I believe that as an association, we can work jointly with school districts on non-retention of even tenured teachers. I've been involved with transfers of non-tenured teachers based on performance. I've been involved with non-retention of non-tenured teachers based on performance. I think that we are here as professionals, we can work together, and I think this bill takes away the opportunity, it takes away what we believe is our professional right in order to operate our education business. And I would encourage you to not pass this bill out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Dietrich? Seeing none. Are there any additional members on the teleconference line who wishes to testify on House Bill 217? Any additional members of the public here in Juneau? If not, we'll close public testimony, and it is the intent of the chair to recess until 7 p.m., at which point we will come back and debate all the issues that we've heard and try to put something in order. We are recessed until 7. Since my good colleague
room to
call House Labor and Commerce back into session here, 7:17 p.m. And for the record, my Representative Cott, Representative Porter, Representative Cabina, Representative Elton, and Representative Roepberg are in attendance, as well as Representative Masick. We're continuing the saga of House Bill 217, Labor and Commerce. I hope you had an opportunity to at least think about some of the discussion that has taken place over the last 2 days. I think we've heard a lot of testimony, I think, from both sides of the aisle. Former colleague used to say, some of my friends like it, some of my friends don't, and I agree with my friends. Yeah, and that's where we're kind of at, I think, with this particular case, although I think there are some issues that we might want to at least address. Some were brought up yesterday. And probably through some of the discussion that took place, we probably have additional questions or suggestions on how to make, I wouldn't say a bad bill a good bill, but a better bill. No, maybe a bill a bill.
You've been reading the Daily News too much.
Or a good, let's see. Well, the only other option is a good bill a bad bill. Anyways, having said that, I will now open the committee up for a discussion on House Bill 217, Representative Porter.
Chairman, we have the word draft in front of us. I believe that there's room for at least a technical amendment that probably won't get a lot of debate on page 2. The removal of lines 10 and 11 because of the removal of the previous paragraph, that's not necessary.
I would concur with that. I think that was an oversight on our behalf.
Mr. Chairman.
When the CS was ordered, Representative Roper.
I think the good gentleman from College Village could add the, there's apparently another correction needs to be made on the first page, on 9-7, about that arbitration. Is that after the end also?
I assume we do these independently.
Oh, okay. I thought that was not in there correctly.
Yeah,
or something,
it has to be removed, I think, as well.
Okay, we're going to do separate amendments?
Okay. Let's move amendment number one, conceptual amendment number one. And is that the motion, Representative Porter?
Just page 2, line 10 and 11.
So there is a motion to delete lines 10 and 11, page 2. Is there objection?
Not objection, Mr. Chair, but I assume that means we're going to have to make a minor adjustment on line 9 and move the and up to line 6. What, a period after years?
Yes.
I would assume that that's incorporated in the motion that Mr. Porter made.
Yeah, that would be a technical.
We'll look at that as a friendly.
So we are going to delete the semicolon, add and. No, we're going to add and. As well. So is there objection to that motion as amended? Well, seeing none, that has carried, passed.
Mr. Chairman.
And I think the next, Representative Cabina.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move then to just delete section 6.
Objection.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Cabina?
I guess I recommend that motion because of the discussion we had about school boards and you know, them making the recommendation or them already making the decision and then coming back and they're the one that they're going to appeal to, and you know, I guess to be honest with you, I'm uncomfortable about working with this bill completely. I mean, what I wish would happen is that we would take this bill and put it with people from the teaching profession and the school boards and et cetera, and work on some solutions here that actually work. But if we're going to work with the bill, I don't think we can work with it in this way. I don't think this is appropriate, and from what we heard in testimony, this really won't work.
Are you through?
I don't know.
Well, there's an objection. We'll just discuss it. I would agree, based on what I heard, that there's a little bit of a problem here, but I think if we delete Section 6 in its entirety, then we have nothing in the event that there's a teacher that is fighting tenureship available.
Well, no, I don't agree with that.
We'd
go back to the status quo, which would be get rid of the judicial review and still have a de novo trial.
I think based on some of the discussion we heard, that the noble trial is an expensive proposition.
I agree.
Representative Porter?
if you would include sections 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 all together, I might go for that. And the rest of the statute. But
I would agree with you wholeheartedly.
Well, I mean, it would have to include the whole statute for me to go on. That is what was happening. I'll have to admit, too, that I have some degree of discomfort with the total process that's left, but I think I have more discomfort with the requirement for a de novo trial and the expenses that incurs, considering that notwithstanding what we'd like to be able to do, revenues are such that without some very fortuitous circumstance over the next 5 years, these budgets are going to have to come down more. And now's the time, I think, to provide opportunities for administrations, school administrations, to manage and not tie their hands.
Representative Elton.
Thank you, Chair. Hopefully you'll give me a little bit of latitude, because I know there's a motion on the table and should be probably speaking to the motion, but I want to say something that's philosophical and broader than the motion. I mean, I think we've heard some great testimony, and I've learned about some new problems, and a lot of that's because of the sponsor and because of the debate that this bill has sparked. And I guess the reason I want to say this now, while we've got this motion on the floor, is I think the committee probably needs to determine something, whether we're going to go through and we're going to try and incorporate a little bit of what everybody wants to have happen. But I think there's another alternative, and one that I'm becoming increasingly comfortable with, and that is, and I think it's compelling after the testimony, that we know we've got a problem. Right? I think even the testimony has gotten us to discuss, to some extent, what the problem is. I'm a little bit cautious because I think the solution in a large district is maybe different than the solution in an REAA. And when we start monkeying around with the statutes to try and come up with some of the stopgap things, I'm not sure we should do that lightly or quickly. And I'm not speaking against the bill, because there are elements of this bill that I really like, and I think the elements that I don't like, what I've liked about them is they prompted a lot of discussion. Just concerned that if we pass a bill out, what we're going to end up doing is we're going to end up addressing part of the problems, and we've heard other problems discussed that aren't even addressed here. I don't think we should maybe take some of these issues like de novo trial off the table, or tenure from 2 years to 5 years or 4 years or 3 years, or keeping it what it is, because I think some of the other solutions are going to require a little bit of leverage in the future. And what you do when you try to put together something that addresses all the problems and is a comprehensive bill, if you take these issues off the table, you're losing leverage down the way to fix other problems. For example, I'd like to keep de novo trial and leverage it into some of the problems with tenure that we've talked about, or the economic crunch that some of the districts feel, especially those districts like my district that are at the cap. So I guess what I'm arguing for is not arguing against this bill, because there are elements of this bill that I think address some problems. I'm just not sure they're the right answers now. What I'm arguing for is taking this as a starting point and working with, we've heard some, I think, reasonable people from PTA, from NEA, from the administrators, and from the teachers. And I guess I'd like to see these people come together with something. I also think that we need to have a little bit of a hammer, and maybe keeping this bill is a hammer, right? Maybe this keeping this bill is going to spark that kind of search for a solution. I'll just wrap up by saying, you know, that I don't think the parents are all that concerned about teacher tenure from 2 to 4 years. Parents that I've talked to are more concerned about the ones that are tenured that are in the system, and this bill doesn't address that problem. I mean, administrators, the problems we've heard from the administrators is this is maybe a small managerial tool, but certainly the problems that they've got are best defined as prioritized by the superintendent from Juneau as first funding, and then the RIP management provision, and then this. I'd like to have the committee consider, before we start going through and making individual amendments, setting up a subcommittee, maybe with the sponsor of this as chair, and incorporating some of the different stuff that we've heard.
Well, let me withdraw my motion, just because we're sort of not talking on it, and if I need to make it, I'll make it again, okay?
President Porter?
I guess then I won't have to ask your indulgence to tie down the amendment, because we can do that. I guess for what it's worth, for the last 2 years, these issues have been in the legislature. And while I haven't tried it directly, it's been tried, I'm told, you know, that kind of approach. Let's get them together. And it hasn't met with any success. I think that passing this legislation out, the closer it gets to fruition, the closer people are going to get to being forced to get together and maybe come up with a solution before it gets passed into law, if that is the case. Or maybe not, maybe it becomes law, but there's just too much divergent opinion on these issues, in my experience over the last 2 years and talking to both sides, that, you know, it's kind of like the Marine Pilots thing. And it's too bad that we've had those two back-to-back, but I suffered through that last year too. And tried to talk to people, and, well, gosh, what about this and that? And I guess I'm pooped. Maybe it's just this week, but...
You have a right to be pooped. We'll excuse that.
Well, but, I mean, on Marine pilots and on teacher contracts, and I look at this as a damn negotiations. I'm sorry, but I really do, and that frustrates me also, but... Notwithstanding that, we've been at it for quite a while, and if we're going to be left in the middle to write laws instead of letting people sit down and reach mutual agreements, so be it. You know, but to me, the further this thing gets along the process of getting passed, the more motivation there's going to be for getting together and coming in at the last committee of referral, which is going to be on the other side, and say, well, we've worked something out. How about this?
Representative Elton?
Just in very, I find myself nodding as Representative Porter is talking. And I guess the only point upon which I would diverge is that the closer it gets to fruition, because I think the closer this bill gets to fruition, the less school boards and PTA, for example, are going to be inclined to want to talk. Because they'll feel that, hey, I mean, why not hold out and just go for the whole enchilada? But I don't disagree with what you're saying. I also think you've probably got more of an excuse to be tired, this week especially than any of the rest of us. I don't know. I don't think we disagree. I think how we get there is maybe the problem.
And having sat on a committee that heard many of these issues over the last 2 years, I can share Representative Porter's concern. We have dealt with these over the last 2 years, and it's frustrating just to see things kind of not move. I hate to invoke any kind of legislative action in these areas. I'd much rather see the sides come together, and like with the Marine Pilots, he took the words right out of my mouth when he said, or at least we may not be entirely happy, but it's something we can live with. And in this particular case, we haven't seen it. Representative Massey.
Through the chair, I have some serious problems with this bill as well. My district's been contacting me regarding this here, and I have many, many teachers who are really concerned with what this piece of legislation will do. And I'd like to just note too that I've heard many things since I've come here. I'm a freshman legislator, and this is the first time I'm hearing about this issue, and I don't know what was said about it in the past session. And it's a really complex issue. I think there's many different sides who this is going to affect statewide, and looking at our state geographically, it's set up so different. Rural Alaska is completely different from the urban areas in many aspects, and I'm afraid with the ramifications that this bill will do, it's going to hurt the quality of education for our children. And I'm really concerned about that. I don't know what your wishes are for it, but I would like to see more work done on it. This is the first time, second day that we're having a hearing on it, and all of the people who have been calling in have serious problems with this bill. And I know we need to do what's best for the state. People elect us here to do the job for everyone, and it's kind of hard when you have your districts divided up. And I know, as I said before, geographically it's pretty tough to please everyone. And I think with the way the language is written in this bill, it's going to hurt not only the teachers but also the children in the schools. And when I campaigned, I said I'd like to see better education, and I'm really proud of the fact too that the Mat-Su Valley has the highest SAT scores, and the quality of an education can be improved. There's room for it to be improved. However, I don't believe that this will fall in that line, so I just really feel we need to do more work on it.
Again, there's been a lot of work done. And this bill, admittedly, is a little bit different than the ones plural that we had before us over the last 2 years. But there are some similarities. And I do appreciate your comments. I think all of us ran on trying to bring and instill better education in the state. I think it's a goal for all of us. None of us, I'm sure, spoke against that. So I can appreciate your concerns and comments and respect for your district's views. Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to say that this bill had substantial work done in the House committee. There was a very large subcommittee with a sponsor and numerous people that were involved and with this project, and it's been a significant amount of time. And the bill was substantially changed from that. There was even revisions made on the way over here, and substantial compromises have already been made. I think those efforts and the long history of this bill really militate to me, even though I have certain philosophical problems with certain aspects of it, particularly the judicial review provisions, which trouble me somewhat, that I think would be this bill is needed to provide the administrations of the various school districts in the state a tool in which they can manage their budgets and their personnel. And without particularly the layoff provisions in here, there's going to be major crises occurring overnight, because the districts will find themselves in a position where they will be, their hands will be tied in managing their budget and personnel problems. And I would say that the biggest advantage of this bill immediately would be in the rural areas of the state, where we have smaller areas. And that when the 3% cut affects those smaller districts, that layoff provision would be triggered off. And as we heard tonight from Mr. Van Slyke, in a middle-sized community for Alaska like Juneau, that 3% may be a little harder to achieve, even. So it may not really be triggered even in a current budget situation. So I think there's the economic exigencies of moving this legislation to really revolve a lot around the layoff provisions in here. And I think that's really needed in the state.
And I must apologize, when I seen this bill right across and seen the words arbitration, I requested it to come to Labor and Commerce, and having looked at it, probably shouldn't have got it here.
Well, Hess did a lot of work on it, and the sponsor made a lot of compromises.
Representative Covina.
Mr. Chairman, the fact is there's only one part of this bill that is really clear-cut, and that is the tenure, 2 years or 3 years or 4 years or 5 years. The layoff clause is not clear-cut at all. I mean, there has to be more to this layoff provision than just saying the board can lay off. I mean, how does it relate to non-tenured teachers? Is there anyone going to look at it to approve some kind of a plan besides the school board, who can then just arbitrarily start laying people off? Is there something that needs to go to the commissioner? Have they looked at other things? I mean, is it fair to hire administrators and then lay off teachers, which was reported here? The problems that were mentioned on the courts or the judicial review. There's only one part in here that I think is just a pure cut and dry, whether you want 2, 3, or 4, or 5 years for tenure. But this layoff provision is not a provision that I would cite this wholeheartedly to be in the law just like it's written.
Further discussion.
In fact, Mr. Chairman, I would suspect that this layoff provision would cause far more court battles. This layoff provision, as written, would be very costly in the courts, because this would be in the court virtually every time it happened. You know, we haven't had anyone here from the legal department explain to us the ramifications of what that means, nor really the ramifications of the judicial review in either.
Representative Porter, did that come up in your committee? Because
it just went through judiciary too. And there didn't seem to be any indication that this was going to foster litigation. Although, not to start repeating discussions that we've had on other subjects, it's pretty hard to. I mean, that is the, unfortunately, that is the way that the disputes are resolved, and whenever there is a new statute that doesn't please everyone, it's more than likely going to be tested. But certainly no one said this is unconstitutional or this is obviously in violation of existing case law that would be struck immediately upon being presented or anything like that.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Porter, in on page 3, line 8, you probably can address this, but I think it was inserted at in the Judiciary Committee, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. And it was supposed to be a clarifier, but to me it's more of a confusifier.
This does not apply to a teacher who has not acquired tenure?
Yeah.
Well, there's another section in the existing law that deals with non-tenured teachers. That's why they want to make sure that this wasn't to be held in conflict with that.
That was the reason for the insertion. So there is, when I read this, I thought, oh, geez, now we're just hitting the tenured teachers. And the untenured, non-tenured teachers were off the hook.
No.
But in essence, there is another provision in law that does cover non-tenured teachers.
But on that, I don't think there's a clause in here that says you have to let go non-tenured people before you can lay off tenured people.
It's a possibility that there are labor contracts that say that, but...
Well, I wouldn't know of one, but...
It's not an unusual provision in a labor contract, but I don't know. I don't...
It would say... All non-tenure teachers must be laid off before tenure.
I would suspect that would be an arbitration, or I mean a negotiation position that any discussion.
I would
whether
expect
it's in your contracts, I don't know.
I would expect that would be in the contract, or at least it would
well,
be
it's in the law right now, Mr. Chairman. Right now, it's in the law that says, you know, non-tenured.
Oh, well, then it's
but no,
not necessary to be in the...
But when you're adding a new layoff provision, I don't see a sentence in here that says, you know, layoffs will go to non-tenured before.
Well, there's nothing in this section that would conflict with that statement if it is at law someplace. So that would be the deciding factor. It's just this section doesn't apply to non-tenured teacher layoff. In other words, I don't know what the requirements of the statute are for laying off a non-tenured teacher. But what we're saying by line 8 is that whatever it isn't that the school district has to establish a 3% basic need loss or a loss of attendance. Whatever it says, I don't know. But
it says for any reason, period.
Is that all?
Mr. Chairman,
and no reason.
I think your interpretation is the same interpretation that I have. And I may be missing Representative Porter's point, but we're talking about... a new section here. We're not talking about an existing section, and the sentence on line 8 leads me to believe that when basic need as determined under statute decreases by 3% or more, districts may place teachers in a layoff status.
Oh,
but then when you read the last sentence, it makes it seem as if when that circumstance arises, the 3% decrease, that it would only apply to the tenured teacher. I think I understand what this was meant to do, but I think in the purpose or in the context of the new section, my interpretation is a lot like the chair's.
I didn't get that to be his interpretation. He asked the question, and especially with the information that Representative Kavina has furnished, there's no doubt in my mind that the law that says non-tenured teachers must be laid off before tenured teachers is the driving law on that issue. Anything that this line 8 means is applying the criteria set up in line 3-7. It's clear they're not talking about non-tenured teachers, they're talking about tenure.
In other words, that sentence only applies to 1421.77a.
That's it.
Why couldn't we say this paragraph then?
Well, because it goes on to
section.
B and C.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Would you want B and C to apply to both non-tenured and tenured teachers, though? Because they set up...
That's why it says section.
I
I mean, when they're talking about primary, secondary, and seniority, things like that, you don't want to take those other people into account? And wouldn't you have to amend the other statute then with the same kind of criterion? In B and C, et cetera?
The sponsor of the legislation and those testifying for it said that this section, the whole section, applies to tenured teachers.
Right.
There's another total section that deals with non-tenured teachers.
I understand.
And they wanted to make sure that this section only applied to tenured teachers, not.
It may be better to make this the first sentence in A or the last sentence in
E.
F, or E, F, I guess. But the point is that it's correct when it refers to the section.
I understand that, but then well, wouldn't we have to put B and C in the non-tenured teacher provisions in the statute then, if that was going to be balanced?
Okay.
I mean, wouldn't we have to put the C particularly, shouldn't that be inserted in the non-tenured portion of the statute also? Or,
this bill doesn't deal with non-tenured teachers, and I just assume not open that up.
Oh, okay.
I don't know anything about it.
Okay.
Representative Felton?
I don't know. I went over to check with a representative from the department to see if there was a quick answer, and I won't embarrass the representative by asking her to come up and try and explain it because she indicated she didn't have an answer. This may be the kind of question that I hate to put myself in the hands of an attorney from the Department of Law, but I guess that's where I'll start feeling comfortable, is if they say this is it. I mean, you've heard testimony that says this is a problem, and I don't know whether it's a problem or not.
You find one that says it is, I'll find one that says it isn't.
Gets right back to Representative Kabina's allegation that this is going to cause a lot of litigation.
Since there is another section that evidently covers non-tenured teachers, it's probably not as much of a problem as I initially thought. I wasn't aware there was another section. We should have known that.
Is there another section, Mr. Chair, that covers non-tenured?
I mean, well, there must be. He quoted some law that isn't in here.
My understanding was that the non-tenured were covered under contractual provisions and not under statutory provisions.
This is the statewide contract, right?
Well, there's non-retention. So there's a non-retention section that talks about a teacher who has not acquired tenure rights is subject to non-retention the following school year. The expiration of their contract for any cause that the employer determines adequate. You can dump a non-tenured teacher for 2 years because of anything.
That's
you don't even need to give a reason.
Probationary.
Yeah.
That is another category. As long as it's constitutional. Not for discrimination.
A handy guy to have around.
I was a non-tenured teacher and negotiated a contract for the first time. I knew the law. But I knew also, this was interesting, that they could dump me for any reason. And you should have heard it the second year when I was going to get my tenure rights. And after I had negotiated, and we had effective election against NEA, and we won, AFT, and you could hear a pin drop. And that time the board voted on teachers individually. You could hear a pin drop, and when they voted 5-0 to to rehire me, there was just this sigh through the thing. And a school board president looked up and said, "What? Was there ever any question?" I have been there.
I was president at the Employees Association of the Police Department when I was a sergeant. And then I went on the other side of the table when I was chief. So I know.
Is there further debate on House Bill 217?
Mr. Chairman, there was a question about that Section 6 thing. I don't know if that's right or wrong to leave that in there, but if we're going to do anything with this thing. Then
I think Section 6, line 7 on page 4, referring to arbitration, since it was removed from the original bill, it should probably read, attain, on line 7, attain tenure rights is not entitled to judicial review. So arbitration has been removed.
We can get some verification from the sponsor or something, is that right? Okay. This arbitration order?
Yeah.
Well, are we going back to work on this bill as it is?
I mean,
we're going to try to.
I'd like to move this bill to held over to the interim, but I don't think I got the votes.
You got the support of the sponsor, I'd be more than happy to. To entertain his ideas.
We bring him up to the table and let us, maybe he'd give us his views. If he'd like to.
Mr. Ivan, you want to make any comment? Come on up to the table. In fact, you ought to be up here anyways.
Sorry.
I'm sorry, I didn't recognize you. I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All I could make my comment is that I felt that we've worked hard on this bill through all the committee process, and I think this is third committee referral, and throughout the committees we presented the bill as it is, and some amendments had been made in the Hess and had gotten into the subcommittee. We agreed with we compromised on the amendments that were made, and like I've heard the debate on both sides. I've heard some comments from the committee members. I feel that this is a good bill that will give some, as I kept saying, some flexibility to the school districts, the REAs, to work out in the event of declining revenues, and that this bill will give the school district again flexibility to deal with that. Hiring of teachers, firing of teachers, laying off of teachers when necessary. And I would like to see the bill continue on and go forth. I felt that the discussions were provided and ample opportunity given to all parties throughout the process as it was heard, and that's all I could make to this point.
Well, Representative Ivan, in light of it being fairly late in the session and still having this to proceed to this committee, to the floor of the House, and then over to the dark side, there's no guarantee. In fact, I would be extremely surprised if it were to pass both sides and be forwarded to the governor for his signature, but I would suspect that wherever this bill ends up, that you will be willing to work with both sides and trying to facilitate some type of compromise or consensus and develop that over the interim period if that is what happens with this matter. Is that pretty correct in my assumption?
Well, I'd like, my interest, of course, is to see the bill passed. If, as a sponsor, I'd like to see that. Wherever possible.
Yeah, and I completely agree with advancing it and trying to get both sides to the table. All I'm saying is that we could adjourn on Monday, and the bill won't pass. We know that, but it'll be further along in the process at some point, and I would assume that you'll be willing to work with the two sides during the interim in developing a better bill, if there is such a thing. I'm not saying there is. Maybe we got the best we can get. I don't know. Representative Elton?
Mr. Chair, a question of the sponsor, and I'm tossing this out. I don't know whether this is a good idea or not, so I'm going to fess up before I make the suggestion. I wonder, Representative Ivan, if this would be a possible solution. I mean, if we amended tenure, it's now 4 years in this bill. I think sections 1 and 2. If we amended that to 3 years, moved sections 1 and 2 forward, and then worked on the interim on the layoff and the binding arb or de novo trial or judicial review provisions in the interim. Would that be acceptable? Move move it forward as a simpler bill addressing tenure at 3 years perhaps, and then keeping the more complicated portions behind for Intermore?
I respect your offering your opinion, but I feel, you know, I brought this, presented this bill as it is, and would like to see it advance and become law, if possible, as it is.
Is there further debate on...
Mr. Chairman?
Well, I guess I would move that we, as a minimum, strike on line 7 the words arbitration or... That would ensure it conforms with the rest of the section. Is there objection? Seeing none, that conceptual amendment has been adopted. Not saying that I agree with the section, but at least if we're on board with a reasonable section. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee substitute for House Bill number 217, Labor and Commerce, version R, with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Well, yeah. I object, Mr. Chair.
I object as well. I think we have some additional work due on this. I think there may be some additional offerings in the form of amendments. I would ask you respectfully to withdraw your motion.
Well, let's see. Doesn't look too promising out there, does it? I will withdraw my motion, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ivan?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make just a brief comment. I understand that a similar bill, and this bill has been introduced in the previous two sessions, and of course we, throughout the process here, had not received anything from NEA through the committee process, except they told us what was wrong with the bill. Certainly they didn't agree with it, but there's not been any suggested language or changes, nor negotiations until it got to this committee. And, well, it has gone through the committee process, as all bills do down here.
Can you share with us whether or not either side has come to the table? Obviously, there's some that agree with some of the language in here and some of the provisions, and there's another side that don't agree. Have either one of them come to the table and tried to work things out?
All right. Well, we've... let this bill through, like I, you know, I believe in the Hess committee. It got into the subcommittee, and I believe people from NEA were involved in working on the bill, and we accepted as it came out, came forth. I feel that they were given full opportunity to address the bill.
Okay.
Well, I guess it's our opportunity now, Mr. Chairman, and I just, do you want to work off this bill?
Let's try and do what we can with it, but let's take a 5-minute at ease.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I...
And...
Any music.
Representative Roper, what line 10 is to lay House Bill 217 aside, follow the chair, and... respect to those who have been patiently awaiting since 3 o'clock. I understand we have someone that's coming from out of town. We're going to pick up House Bill 284, which is an act relating to the last commercial fishing and agriculture bank.
Outside to folks come out. So more people can...
Did we come up?
We'll go back to the
town. Oh, we'll go back to the...
Okay.
At least not one.
A temporary laying aside.
Yeah.
There's
mine.
I
know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did you?
What are we doing?
Hey, we do have a prime sponsor. That was 284 and Travis.
I went up and trying to learn.
So if you would, tell us everything we needed to know, but not too much. That will make us too inquisitive, at least.
Very brief. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for hearing it and interrupting your other discussion to take us now. I'm actually not the prime sponsor. I'm Cheryl Sutton. I'm aide to Carl Moses. This is a House Fisheries Committee bill, and my boss offered my services to help because they had so many bills in committee, and so that's why I'm here carrying this bill for the committee. In your packets, you have sectional summaries from legal services and from CFAB, and CFAB did a real excellent job in doing cross-references to the sections of the statute and the sections of the bill for your edification. And in addition, you have a sponsor statement, 20 fiscal notes, and numerous letters of support. And I want to add that while you have numerous letters of support in your packet, it does not represent a small portion of the numbers of letters that have come in support of this bill that are in Representative Osterman's office. And there's quite a few in your packet. House Bill 284 seeks to modify and refit CFAB's enabling statute to reflect the evolving commercial law and present-day fishing economy's needs. CFAB was created in 1978, and much has changed in both commercial law and fishing economy since that time. There are two significant changes which would be enacted with the passage of HB 284. The first is permanent ownership by the state through retirement of all but $1 million of the state's initial investment of $32 million. And second, the broadening of the purposes and circumstances for which a fisherman may use his limited entry permit as collateral. The intent of the changes is to make CFAB's loan program more compatible with the needs of the seafood industry. Ed Crane, who flew into town, is president of CFAB, and is here and will offer testimony and be able to answer any of your technical questions that you may have. It's an 18-page bill, and it appears to be very intimidating, but it's not. And I'll let him speak to the bill if it's all right with you.
Thank you very much. In that vein, we will ask Mr. Crane to come up and tell us
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Substantive changes.
And I do. I want to sincerely thank you and your committee as a whole and each individual member. I realize this is one more imposition on what's been a very busy week for you. As indicated, my name is Ed Crane, and I'm president of the Alaska Commercial Fishing and Agriculture Bank, which is commonly known as CFAB, C-F-A-B. And for those of you who are relatively new in the legislature and or don't have a close association with the seafood industry, it's quite likely that you probably never heard of CFAB until you saw this bill before you. As Mrs. Sutton indicated, CFAB was a 1978 or an effort of the 1978 legislature to approach a form of privatization, if you will, of financing of the seafood and agriculture industries in Alaska. And the concept essentially was one which was an effort to replicate institutions in what's known as the Federal Farm Credit System in the lower 48. And essentially it was to create a private financing cooperative, which would serve only Alaska residents and Alaska companies, and which ultimately would become self-sustaining. The state of Alaska invested initially $32 million as seed capital so that this new institution would have equity. Over the years, CFAB, on the strength and with the use of that equity, has borrowed consistently. We borrow from an institution called the Bank for Cooperatives in Denver, and to the point where we have at times had over $100 million of loans outstanding, even though there's never been more than $32 million of state capital. And in total, over the years, we've made something over $600 million in loan advances. The theory, again, was that over time, the capital, the equity owned by borrowing members would be accumulated and replace the state's equity. When you do business with CFAB, that is, when you become a borrower, you must buy stock in CFAB. We do business only with stockholders, and every customer must become a stockholder. At this point, as of today, we have approximately a little over $17 million of money that has been invested by these borrowing members. Now, another part of the scheme, or the concept, if you will, is embodied in that part of the statute, the existing statute, which said that by the year 2000, or within 20 years of the state's initial investment, which took place in 1980, CFAB must retire, that is, repurchase that stock from the state, the entire $32 million. As of today, we've retired actually $22 million of it. There is still $10 million yet to go, and of course, 5 years to go. One of the things, the most important, the really significant thing that this bill does, and it's in a sense, it's really the only point of public policy, if you will, a political significance that this bill asks you to address, is to modify that requirement so that, again, as Mrs. Sutton indicated, CFAB ultimately will retire only $31 million of the total $32 million, and $1 million of state capital will remain as permanent equity, or that CFAB will survive with that $1 million of state capital, in addition to whatever member capital is acquired. There are a couple of reasons for that. One is there's an anomaly, as near as I can tell, an unintended anomaly in the original statute, which says that when the entire $32 million is retired, the statute lapses. And if the statute lapses, there is no CFAB. It just goes poof, disappears. Well, obviously, that could be adjusted in a variety of ways. And we've known about that for some time, and we do have, as I indicated, 5 years to deal with it. But this is a way of dealing with it. The other more significant thing is that a large part of CFAB's service to fishermen, to commercial fishermen, is and the needs of commercial fishermen is premised on the fact that CFAB is the only private lender which has the statutory authority to take a lien on a limited entry permit. No other lender other than the state's own fishing loan program can do that. And because limited entry permits are such a significant part of any fisherman's capitalization, again, that is an increasingly important part of CFAB's business is financing for new permits and also the use of permits as collateral for loans for other purposes. In order to maintain that special status, special in a legal sense as well as a real sense, or in an effort to maintain that special status, we believe it's important to continue the state ownership, the relationship of the state as an owner with CFAB, which in turn rationalizes not only that special status, but the other points of relationship between CFAB and the state. And just to briefly tell you what those are, the legislature does have, under the statute, both the existing statute and our proposed revision here, the legislature does have the authority to direct the legislative auditor to make any sort of audit of CFAB, which it chooses, and that was done once in total, and once a small part of CFAB, the auditor came and looked at quite a few years ago. In addition to that, the state bank examiners in the Department of Commerce examine CFAB each year, a different type of examination than is performed on commercial banks or other institutions, but they do perform an examination each year. and a report is submitted to both the legislature and the administration. The legislative auditor has access to CFAB's independent outside auditors and their work papers, and we routinely send that stuff to the legislative auditor. And finally, the governor of Alaska appoints two of CFAB's seven directors. The other five are elected by and from among the borrowing members. So there is the accountability. CFAB is a strange in structure and concept. It's the state Supreme Court has had occasion to comment, in effect, that CFAB is a little bit farther removed from the state than the Alaska Railroad and some other institutions. But essentially, the state's only relationship is as an owner and, if you will, as a sponsor. That change that I'm referring to, you will find in Section 9 of your bill, which is somewhat convoluted language. I guess that's because of the way things are done in Juneau. It does not specifically mention $32 million, but if you read that carefully, what it does say is that it continues to require CFAB to repurchase all the shares of the stock owned by the state except for $1 million, on whatever amount exceeds $1 million. Now, the remainder of the bill essentially is a total revision. I really shouldn't use that word total. It is a revision of CFAB's statute, 4481. And when I say total, or when I say revision, I certainly do not mean word for word. There's much that is not changed. But what we have brought to bear over the next, over sections 10 through, I think it's 27 or 26, is the experience that we've had over the past 15 years, some of the inconsistencies and gaps that we have encountered in the existing statute, and again, conformity with some of the ways that fishing economics have changed, and also the evolution of the variety of laws affecting commercial lenders. There are certain new or broader powers, if you will, with respect to permit financing, which I mentioned earlier. Those are found in Section 20 of this bill, and some of those items enumerated in Section 20 are new. I'll be happy to discuss any of them that you would like. I don't want to burden this occasion. I can talk about CFAB for many hours, but I really don't want to burden this occasion with unnecessary discourse, but I would be happy to answer any questions that you have or talk about any of these points. I have worked for CFAB for 10 years, almost exactly 10 years, and over that course of time, I guess I've probably been down here to Juneau to have much less significant amendments to the statute probably six times, and my habit has, I have found that candor and total disclosure in all of its forms has served me well with the legislature, and I think those legislators who've been around over that span of time would confirm that CFAB and I personally have a good deal of credibility here. I don't really want to take the trust me approach because I'm not sure that's ever appropriate in the legislature. On the other hand, as I say, I really don't want to burden this occasion with unnecessary discourse. So I will stop now and as I say, tell you that there are both small changes and large changes in terms of substance. But basically, sections 10 through 27 of the bill really address the way CFAB deals with its borrowing membership and not CFAB's relationship with the state. And I will be happy to respond to any questions that you have or attempt to explain any parts of this bill that you may have questions about.
Representative Porter, just personal curiosity, is this the entity that makes the agricultural loans to you?
In theory, it does, Representative Porter, and as you can see by the name, commercial fishing and agriculture have equal billing. in practice, and if you exclude the certain kinds of timber loans that we classify as agriculture, we do very little in the way of farm loans. I believe we only have one loan on the books right now that I would classify as a farm loan.
Didn't get involved in all those.
It's not the revolving loan.
We did have 1 point McKenzie loan, and it worked out fine for us.
Boy, are you lucky.
Well, we like to think of it as smart, but I think probably lucky is maybe a better word. But yeah, the state does have an agriculture revolving loan fund, which seems to be quite attractive to most bankable farmers, and that does not give us much of a market there.
Mr. Crane, can you tell me what your relationship is with the Federal Farm Credit System?
Well, as I indicated, we're a borrower of what is called the National Bank for Cooperatives, which is one of the institutions of the Federal Farm Credit System. There are quite a number and variety of institutions in that system, and they've actually undergone quite a few changes, or each of them have undergone quite a few changes over the last few years. And an example of that is until 3 or 4 years ago, or perhaps longer, time flies, maybe 6 years ago, our borrowing was from the Spokane Bank for Cooperatives, which was a regional part of that system. There was a massive merger which involved 10 regional banks and a central bank, and now there's just one bank called the National Bank, which is what we borrow from.
Representative Elton.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to comment that I was on a previous committee that heard this bill, and there were a lot of questions, and I think that... can't remember what the recommendation of the committee was, but I think there was...